All rise. The Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're back on the record at this time. This is State of Nevada versus District Court, and more specifically Armstrong. If counsel will announce their appearance for the record, and if they wish to reserve any time, please state.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Bruce Nelson, Deputy District Attorney, appearing on behalf of the State of Nevada, and I would ask to save 5 minutes for the vote.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the respondent, Real Party in Interest, my name is Dan Albrecht. Seated with me at counsel table is Counsel Craig Newland. I will be arguing today on behalf of our state.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Justices. The issue before this court is a fairly simple one. Are the results of a blood alcohol analysis admissible into evidence if it isn't drawn within 2 hours of the defendant's crash? Or perhaps put another way, is it legal to drive under the influence of alcohol in the state of Nevada if your blood test is not done within 2 hours of your driving? Well, if the district court order stands, the answer to that second question is yes, it is, because the district court has in effect precluded the state in this case from prosecuting the defendant for drunk driving. The facts are pretty simple. The defendant crashed at 1:30. His blood was drawn 2 hours and 21 minutes later at approximately 3:51. He told the police that he quit drinking at 10 o'clock, which would be 3.5 hours before he crashed. Now, the defense initially argued that because the test was beyond 2 hours, it was inadmissible for any purpose. They were trying to graft the two-hour rule of subsection C onto subsections A and B. The district court apparently rejected that argument, but did accept the one that the state was not allowed to retrograde extrapolate the defendant's alcohol level back to the time of driving because, quote, there were too many variables. The district court never told us what those variables were, but that was the basis of its decision. This court has already recognized the validity of retrograde extrapolation in State versus Anderson. That was reaffirmed in State versus Burcham, where the court held that we don't need an expert for grand jury, but we could use one at trial to establish retrograde extrapolation. I'm unaware of any decision where a court has held that retrograde extrapolation is invalid ab initio, that is, that it's not a valid science. There have been one or two cases cited by the defense, for example, where because of the unique facts of that particular case, retrograde was held not to be admissible. For example, in the Dubois case that they cited, the defendant drank, crashed, continued to drive, and continued to drink. He had an unknown amount of alcohol after the collision, anywhere from 3 to 12 beers. The court said in that case, because you can't subtract out the post-collision drinking because you don't know how much it is, you can't use retrograde extrapolation to show his alcohol level. But the court did find that retrograde extrapolation is valid. Yes, there are variables, but they really don't matter in this case, because here's the key issue, or the key variable, if you will. The defendant quit drinking 3.5 hours before he crashed. In the literature and the cases that I cited in my brief, particularly the National Institute on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse, they said if you have an empty stomach, your alcohol level peaks 30 to 45 minutes after you quit drinking. And if you have a full stomach, you peak 1.5 to 2 hours and 15 minutes after you quit drinking.
Does it make any difference if you have a full stomach? Aren't some of these variables as to what you ate and fatty content as opposed to non-fatty content and all kinds of other little variations?
That can affect the length of time that it takes you to peak in your alcohol level.
Doesn't it affect the absorption rate?
It can affect the absorption rate, but it doesn't matter in this case. Because even if we use just the literature and cases cited by the defense, their literature was empty stomach, 45 minutes to an hour, full stomach, 1 to 3 hours. Here the defendant was 3.5 hours. He had to have peaked and started down at the time he crashed.
How does the weight of the person affect this?
Well, the general rule, the more you weigh, the more alcohol it takes to get you to the same level. If, for example, Judge Douglas, who's probably half my weight, and I had each had fathers, his alcohol level would be approximately double mine.
What if you're an alcoholic?
I appreciate being half your weight, but that's not going to help you today.
Mr. Nelson, what if you're an alcoholic? Does that affect it? If somebody's an alcoholic as to absorption and to when you actually when you're impaired?
Alcoholism per se, no. What really matters is your weight, the alcohol content of what you're drinking, and whether you're taking food with the alcohol. You can build up a tolerance to alcohol, so it may not have the same effect on you, and you can build up an elimination rate, but it will not really affect the level you reach. The only thing that truly affects that is food, but here where it's such an outside extreme, even food doesn't matter.
What about urination, if you urinate?
That will not have a significant effect on your alcohol level, no. Because once the alcohol has gotten to your urination, it's essentially out of your system. So it doesn't really back up or anything like that. Here, because the time limit is so extreme, there's no way he could not have peaked. As Dr. Hyatt put it in the testimony before the district court, quote, it's hard to imagine a scenario in which it, being the alcohol level, would not have reached a peak at that time.
And that's the record, page 85?
That's the transcript of the hearing, page 41, lines 20 to 22.
Right, but the appendix, page 85?
Yes, Justice. And he also testified to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty that the defendant would have been above an 08. The thing to bear in mind about retrograde extrapolation is I am never going to go to a jury and say this is precisely the defendant's alcohol level when he was driving, but I don't need to do that. All I need to show is he was 0.08 or more at the time he was driving. So, for example, his elimination rate in this case is irrelevant. That ranges anywhere from 01 to 03, according to the literature, but because his level had to be higher than his test of 0.18, that means he was somewhere between a 0.20 and a 0.24 when he was driving, if we extrapolate backwards. This case is not the case to find that there a variable in retrograde extrapolation is going to matter, because the 3.5 hours basically eliminate all the variables except for the elimination rate variable. Now, there was another person who testified at the evidentiary hearing, a Mr. Cook. He said that he didn't like retrograde extrapolation. He never said he was an expert in it. In fact, the district court never found he was an expert in it. But he said because the defendant might be that one in a million guy, say he would be the one guy who had the 03 elimination rate, that might make a difference somehow. Well, if there's a dispute between two experts, that doesn't mean the evidence is excluded. I think the court in the Mississippi Appellate Court 2006 put it best in State versus Smith. When experts reach different conclusions, the trial court is not required to exclude their testimony as long as it is A, relevant, and B, provided through some type of scientific basis. And as I said, no case is held that retrograde extrapolation does not have a valid basis.
Let me ask Justice Gibbons' favorite question. What's the standard of review in this matter for us? What's our
standard of review in this matter is abuse of discretion. That's what we are arguing in our petition for writ of mandamus and prohibition. The court abuses.
Isn't it a manifest abuse of discretion in the extraordinary writ context?
That's correct, Justice. I'll correct myself. It's a manifest abuse of discretion. The science of retrograde extrapolation does have variables, but so does every science. Take the gold standard, DNA. The expert testifies, I tested the person's blood. It matched the DNA of defendant Johnson, and Johnson's DNA is different from everybody else's. Well, the expert doesn't know that.
But they can quantify that to some degree, can't they?
Yes, but they cannot be absolute. Likewise, in retrograde, as I said, we can quantify to some degree what his alcohol level was. We know he's between a 2.0 and a 2.4, but we don't have to get an exact match. It's enough for us to simply say he was 0.08 or above.
Mr. Nelson, in this case, do we have concerns or issues as to the issue of one blood draw and the fact that there was a lack of information regarding the food consumption?
No, two reasons. Number one, Anderson, the court case where this court held the retrograde extrapolation is valid, also involved one blood draw. The court nonetheless found the retrograde was proper. Two, the fluid consumption and so on might slow things down, but still the 3 hours is the outside range.
So, Mr. Nelson, you're asking us to look at this like we would any other expert, and that is to ensure that, in fact, his credentials were properly considered by the court, that he would assist the trier of fact and leave the rest of it to the determination of the fact finder juries, not to eliminate the evidence altogether, but to let them decide to what extent they would use it?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's exactly what this court did with bite mark evidence in the Blodsworth versus State case. It held that, yes, there are inconsistencies or perhaps variables, if you will, in bite mark evidence, but that's for the jury, not for the judge. The jury should be the one to hear this case and determine whether it agrees with the state or whether it doesn't agree. The other point is, even if the defendant somehow was going up, he wasn't, but even if he was, the evidence would have to be that he went from an 07 at time of crash to a 0.18 2 hours later without consuming any alcohol. Now, is that theoretically possible? Maybe. If he left the bar, had slammed down 10 drinks right before he left, and then immediately got stopped. Of course, that's directly contrary to what he told the police. He said, I quit drinking at 10 o'clock, 3.5 hours earlier.
And he's either in the wreck, in the ambulance, or at the hospital from the point of the collision on, correct?
Correct. There was absolutely no evidence in this case that he consumed any alcohol post-drinking. He was found by the police drinking a cup of coffee, but they were very careful to note it was a cup of coffee, and he never claimed to consume any alcohol after he crashed. And then it all saved the post-drinking perhaps for the next case of whether a defendant should be able to benefit from post-drinking, but we don't really need to address
that.
But
that's not in this case.
No, that is not in this
case. Can you try this matter without the retrograde extrapolation?
We cannot show that he was a 0.08 or more at time of driving without being able to introduce evidence that he was a 0.08 or more at time of driving. In effect, I guess the best thing I can analogize it to would be like the court saying in a murder case, yeah, you can proceed with the case, but I'm going to prohibit you from introducing any evidence that anyone was killed. The court has, in effect, killed our prosecution of this defendant.
And Mr. Nelson, I assume that the record, at least my review of the record, adequately supports that no other medication was given to the defendant in this case at the time of ambulance transport, anything that would also processed through the system and might be somehow measured in the blood alcohol?
No, there isn't, Justice. The gas chromatograph measures ethanol. So unless the ambulance was feeding him liquor while he was being transported to the hospital, it wouldn't show up anyway. Okay. The defense really stands and falls in this case, if you will, on the Mata decision out of Texas. That's really the only authority they've cited. Mata was a case where the court held retrograde extrapolation is proper and is admissible, but they held in that case the expert did not sufficiently quantify or qualify retrograde extrapolation to allow it to be used. It's perhaps ironic that in a subsequent decision, another Texas court held that that exact same expert was qualified and did present enough evidence to use retrograde extrapolation. In that case, the expert did not testify how many drinks the defendant had or when he quit drinking. Here we know that. Therefore, Mata is readily distinguishable. It simply holds that if you're going to call an expert, the expert has to be able to explain the science. Well, Dr. Hyatt explained the science in this case. I'll just make a couple of other observations. The defense cited a Massachusetts Law Review article from 1985 talking about the dangers of the single test that Justice Douglas asked me about. But here's a quote from that Law Review article. Evidence that a person had stopped drinking more than 90 minutes before he began to drive, for example, would suggest that his peak BAC, blood alcohol concentration, had been reached before the driving incident and would imply that his BAC had been declining from some time before the incident. An inference that his time of offense blood alcohol was at least as high or higher than the test alcohol would have strong support. So even in the article cited by the defense, the authors recognize that when sufficient time elapses, the person has to be declining. They said 90 minutes. Here we have 210 minutes. The rhetorical question I asked at the beginning of this case was whether it's legal to drive under the influence of alcohol in the state of Nevada. It really isn't rhetorical. It is the question in this case, because if the court's decision stands, then every drunk driver simply has to delay his test for more than 2 hours, and then he's home free. That's not the law in any state. It's not the law in Nevada, and it's not the law that this court should follow. This court should issue the writ, order the district court.
Well, their point, though, they rebut that and say that what we're saying is you have to have two blood tests so you can chart whether it's going up or down. I think you're overstating their argument a bit. So could you comment on the idea that what they're really saying is you need two blood tests so you have not a point but 2 points to make a line?
Certainly. Well, first of all, the defense is wrong when it says we can automatically get two blood tests, because the statute that they cite, NRS 484C160, does talk about multiple tests, but only in the context where the defendant refuses to take a test. There is no general rule in Nevada that says we can get multiple blood draws when a defendant basically complies with the implied consent. Now, I think we can. There's nothing that constitutionally prohibits it, but it is not a required subject. And even the Mata case said in some cases where you know most of the variables and only have one test, retrograde would still be proper. Mata only held that when you have one test and no variables, then it should never come in. Conversely, they said two tests, short time later, it would always come in. We are in the case, because of the time length, where we have enough variables to conclusively say the defendant's alcohol level was going down at the time he was driving. Should we maybe have the police do two tests in all cases? Sure, that would make things easier. But it's not required legally, it's not required constitutionally, and in this case, it's not required to do retrograde extrapolation. Justices, unless you have any other questions of me, I think I'll just stop at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's a little unusual for me to be on this side of the courtroom, and I'll do my best to do it justice. We would submit to the court that the state's argument really misses the point of what the issue is before you. The state would like you to believe that if you deny their writ, that all anarchy will occur, people will be able to drive drunk on the state roads of Nevada, and that for those reasons you should not deny their writ. And I would suggest that this is not an appropriate case for the very narrow circumstance for such extraordinary relief that they are requesting in this case. Because the trial judge did not manifestly abuse her discretion in this case, and for that reason, you should deny their petition. Now, I will touch on a little later the state's far-reaching implications that they argue that this case has, such as legalizing DUI when the blood alcohol is taken outside the 2 hours, or what they claim is a de facto repeal of the statute, because those clearly aren't the case within the narrow confines of what happened in this case.
In this particular case, I guess the one thing that is of concern are, do we know what basis the court exercised its discretion?
We do. She exercised it on the basis of too many unknown variables after sitting in an evidentiary hearing, listening to two expert witnesses testify about what the state wanted to do in this case.
Should and that's the court have at least pointed out what they were, opposed to just too many?
I don't know that she pointed out in the record where those are or what those are, but I can tell you they are in the record, and I will tell you about those in a second if I may. But, Judge, that's exactly the point. She did exactly what you all have instructed trial judges to do in situations like this, and that's to be a gatekeeper of the evidentiary issues raised in the case, to be the person who looks at the evidence, and in this case, not just any evidence, but evidence of an expert witness who's going to come in and essentially tell the jury that our client was drunk at the time that he was driving, which essentially is going to result in the conviction. Now, I would suggest in this case that the relevant consideration for the trial judge was the relevant and the was the evidence relevant and was it the product of reliable methodology? In the Hallmark case, which of course was addressed later in the Higgs case, you all said that the expert, there must be an assistance requirement, that the expert must be able to assist the trier of fact in an essential element of the case, and basically is it relevant and the product of reliable methodology. In the Higgs case, you all went further and said that a trial judge has wide discretion. This court decided not to follow the Daubert case and said that a judge has wide discretion within NRS 50.275 to fulfill the gatekeeping duties on a case-by-case basis. And that's what the judge did in this case. Mr. Nelson is trying to make this a referendum on DUIs, driving under the influences, and back extrapolation. But that's not what this case is about, and that's why you should deny their writ. Now, what we have here is a case of one blood sample taken outside the two-hour limit. We have no other evidence of driving under the influence. There are no percipient witnesses who would say that Mr. Armstrong was exhibiting signs of intoxication, that he was stumbling, that he smelled of alcohol, that he had all the things that we know they put in to DUI reports to support that he was under the influence. We also know there are variables that I'll talk about in a minute. Now, the two-hour rule was designed to address this issue. was designed to address the drinking after the arrest or the drinking shortly after the arrest issue, and that was put in place by the legislature to say if you're within this two-hour period, this presumption arises. Now, that doesn't mean that perhaps a blood sample taken outside the 2 hours can never be used, and in fact, I would respectfully disagree with the state on this issue. I think they can take more than one blood sample, and I think certainly in a case such as this, where they know that they're outside the two-hour time requirement, they should be taking two blood samples. But they decided not to do that in this case. And so in order to present evidence before the jury, the state wants to call an expert. And what did the trial judge do in this case? She listened to the two witnesses. She judged their credibility. She acted as a gatekeeper. The first witness, Mr. Cook, has got over 30 years of experience with Metro. He's a forensic scientist. And he says that extrapolation is grossly inaccurate and is virtually impossible with only one blood draw. And Mr. Nelson would suggest that it's a one in a million thing where somebody wouldn't fit into what they want to do in this case, but that's not what Mr. Cook testified. He testified that there are outliers and that over the course of his career, he saw examples of people who had 0.3, 0.4, and even 0.5 who should have been dead, yet were driving and fairly functional. And he said, that's the problem in this type of science. There are too many variables, such as weight, metabolism, food, what type of food was eaten, when was the food eaten, what type of alcohol was consumed, exactly when was the alcohol consumed.
But let me pause you there. And Justice Douglas had asked you a question about what are the other factors. They weren't articulated by the district court judge. And we know in this case that the state's expert relied on the defendant's statement that he quit drinking at 10 p.m. and he had had two beers over the preceding five-hour period. We know that. So he stops drinking at 10. He's in a wreck at 1:30. And then he's at the hospital and his blood is drawn 2 hours later. We know that he weighed 212 pounds. And we have the state's expert's statement that with no more alcohol being ingested after 10 p.m., that, quote, I would expect that it should have peaked by that time, by 1:30. It's hard to imagine a scenario in which it would not have peaked at that time. The state's expert is saying, look, regardless, let's put all the variables most favorably to the defendant, but accept his statement to the police. If he hadn't said anything to the police, it'd be one thing. But he said he stopped drinking at 10. What do you do with that? We do have some of the variables filled in. We have weight, time he quit drinking, and time.
I do the same thing that the trial judge did with it, and here's what she did with it. He is basically basing his whole opinion on the two statements of Mr. Armstrong. The statement as to how much and when.
Right.
If you look at their own record, and there's a comment by Mr. Nelson and the expert in their question and colloquy after that, the old joke that everybody always has a couple of beers and that it's not credible to them because that's what everybody says. So first of all, they themselves question the credibility of what he said and the evidence of how much he was drinking when and when he stopped. It also assumes a number of other variables. And the variables I just cited were some of the ones in answer to Judge Douglas's question, but the other variables would be, did the officer get it right? He didn't.
Sorry?
Did the officer get it right? Did he get the Mr. Armstrong statement correct? Was Mr. Armstrong of such a mind that he was able to say what he had to drink and when? This was a chaotic accident scene, and I believe Officer Jeter was about the only officer late at night who was on the scene. So we don't have a written statement from my client. We have the officer's memory of whether or not it was correct. And we have an accident in which one car was flipped. It was a pretty violent collision. What effect did that have on our client's state of mind and his ability to recall what he remembered about what he drank and when? And more importantly, Justices, in a cross-examination on page 91 of the record, of the brief of the state, on bait stamp page 91, Mr. Mueller, during that cross-examination, was asking him if the statement's wrong, and he didn't have a couple beers, and maybe Officer Jeter got it wrong, how does that affect your opinion? How does that affect whether or not you can say that for sure at the time 2 hours earlier it was over 08? And he says, quote, can you be more specific about how much alcohol and what time?
That would make it much easier here. And I submit that's the crux. His whole basis for his testimony is on the two statements from Mr. Armstrong that were given to an officer, allegedly, who allegedly got it correct and gives it to the expert. And the trial judge, in looking at the demeanor, looking at the evidence, and looking at those variables, decided that that wasn't probative enough, that the prejudicial effect of an expert testifying to that based upon that basis outweighed the probative value of the evidence and used her gatekeeping authority to keep it out. And then she fashioned a remedy. She said, well, I'm not going to let you bring that in, but I will let you bring in that there was blood drawn and that there was alcohol found in the blood. And that's exactly, I would submit to this court, what a trial judge is supposed to do in balancing the nature of this evidence and balancing the decision she has to make about whether the evidence should come in.
I'm having a little trouble with that. I agree with that premise, but I have read and am now rereading the entire transcript of your hearing, and I don't find within that transcript where the judge said what her concern was, other than the variable factors.
I agree with you, and I think if that's the court's concern, then perhaps it should be remanded for a further order or findings as it relates to what her concerns for the variables were. But I would submit to this court that it's in the record in the testimony of the experts who outlined what those variables were, and we've gone through them.
But they both give their concern on this side and the typical battle of the experts. One says it's okay, the other one says it's not.
But the typical battle of the experts in this case is in the context of a criminal case where Mr. Armstrong has the constitutional protections of a defendant. And there's no doubt, in fact, as very eloquently stated in the Ninth Circuit opinion that we cited, you know, there's no doubt about the horrors of drunk driving and the effect on our community and everybody. But that has to be balanced in our criminal justice system with due process and the Constitution. And the gatekeeper has to look at this and say, at some stage, is this going to mislead the jury? Is the prejudicial effect outweighed by the probative value? And if it wasn't...
Unfair prejudice.
Absolutely. And in this case, it would be. The unknown variables, I think, in this case, and perhaps her order could have been better for you to review, as you have to do now and have outlined these variables. It's not. But I think what the court is clearly saying is that doesn't equal reliable methodology, that because of these variables, it doesn't meet that standard of reliable methodology and therefore shouldn't be allowed into evidence, and that's what she did in this case. What did she not do? She did not invalidate back extrapolation. She narrowed her opinion to the facts of this case. She did not say that the scientific theory is invalid. She simply said, as it's applied to this case, she doesn't feel the evidence should come in. She did not say that if blood's taken outside of 2 hours, it's always excluded. She simply said, in this case, with only one sample and all the unknowns that were testified to, that it shouldn't come in this case. And she did not declare any statute unconstitutional. The issue isn't the judge's ruling as a gatekeeper. The issue, with all due respect, is the investigation of the officer. They didn't get the blood within 2 hours. They didn't exercise the discretion to take more than one blood sample so that they could do a back extrapolation and have a line and tell you whether he was going up and going down. And that's the crux of the expert's testimony, is if you take away the two statements made by Mr. Armstrong, even Mr. Hyatt indicated that he couldn't decide or tell whether it was going up or going down. They didn't have other evidence or interview other witnesses. Who was he with? No one asked him, who was he with? Where were you? What were you doing? No one asked any of the other witnesses at the scene, did he look like he was drunk? Did he exhibit signs of stumbling? Did he seem like he was slurring his speech? There's none of that in their evidence that they're going to present to the jury or that they investigated. And so it's not that their case is gutted by the decision of the gatekeeper in following your direction on how she should look at this evidence and decide whether it comes in, but it lies in their own investigation of the officer who didn't do the things that he should have done. And so to say it don't grant their writ, something that's extraordinary, as we all know, DUI cases will be forever changed, that's not it at all. Because we all know as long as they do an adequate investigation, If they get the blood sample within 2 hours, or in a case where they can't get it within 2 hours, if they take multiple ones, then they probably can come in and do that retrograde extrapolation. But this isn't the issue in this case. I would suggest and submit to you all, the issue in this case is, did the judge abuse her discretion as a gatekeeper of this type of evidence? And on the facts of this case, and the evidence that she had before her, listening to this testimony, and even their own expert who said, I'm basing it entirely on your claim of what Mr. Armstrong said, and if I don't base it on that, I can't tell whether it was going up and down. She did not abuse her discretion, and for that reason, we would ask you to deny the state's writ, let the judge's order stand, and we'll proceed to trial. If there's any questions, I'm happy to try to answer them.
Any additional questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nelson, while you're coming up, I'd like you to address what seems to be the tail end of Mr. Albert's argument, and that is that the judge's order, although perhaps less clear than we might like it to be, simply says, in this case, under these facts, I'm just not going to allow it. Wouldn't that still be okay, and therefore no abuse of discretion, manifest or otherwise?
And Mr. Nelson, we're going to give you 2 minutes because you got 30 seconds.
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you, Justice.
Well, I started to ask it, quickly before you came up.
Very quickly, Justice, the same rationale that would apply to this case would presumably be applied to the judge to other cases. That is, the blood draw was done beyond 2 hours and there was only one blood draw. Frankly, the defense's argument reminds me of the young man who kills both his parents and then comes to court and says, have mercy on me, Judge, I'm an orphan. What they're arguing in this case is, look, well, maybe I lied. Maybe I bumped my head. Maybe I wasn't, in my right mind. And that's all great arguments for the jury. The jury will hear all that. The jury will hear when the officer says he told me 10 o'clock, and then the defendant can explain that away. And the finder of fact can decide that issue. The defendant, to put it bluntly, shouldn't be able, if they're now claiming to tell something false to the police and then turn around and use that to his benefit to exclude evidence against him. Judge Sada, you mentioned there was a battle of the experts, but there really wasn't, because nowhere in the record was Mr. Cook found to be an expert on retrograde extrapolation. In fact, the state specifically objected to that, and the district court never made a finding that he was. It's perhaps a little bit ironic that Mr. Cook fit within the expert described in Mata. One of the things the Mata court condemned the expert for was not doing the math correctly. Well, neither Mr. Mueller nor Mr. Cook did in their hearing. Here's the question by Mr. Mueller. If I represented to you that the defendant told the police officer that the defendant stopped drinking at 10 o'clock, that the collision occurred sometime between 12:30 and 1 o'clock, that would be within the 1 to 3 hour range, wouldn't it? Answer, yes. Well, no, it wouldn't be. Even if the collision happened an hour earlier than everybody said at 12 o'clock and he quit drinking at 10, that's 2.5 hours. That's not the 1 to 3 hour range. Mr. Cook is a very, very good tester of blood to determine its alcohol content and its drug content, but he is not and has never claimed to be an expert on retrograde extrapolation. And that was the only person they produced. The blood was drawn. There was only one blood draw. There's, as I said before, there's no requirement that there be more than one. So, Justices, I think everything's been pretty much addressed. This is a case for the jury, not the judge. The judge manifestly abused her discretion and would end DUI prosecutions if the blood isn't drawn within 2 hours and there's only one blood test. Unless you have any other questions of me, I'd submit it on that. Thank you.
Thank counsel for spirited arguments this day. This matter will stand submitted. I would note for the record that Justice Hardesty was not participating today, but will review the tape and will be part of the decision in this matter.